Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is TCP Packet Tracing, Part 2. Today's presenters are Robert Boretti and Marvin Knight. Robert has been with the IBM Corporation for 14 years and supporting the IBM HTTP server and HTTP plugin for 9 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer with the LT WebSphere application server support. Marvin has been with the IBM Corporation for 29 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer supporting the IBM HTTP server, HTTP plugin, and Edge components. Prior to that, he worked in ISPF development and support. At this point in time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Robert and Marvin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Robert Boretti. And today's presentation, titled TCP Packet Tracing Part 2, welcome to the presentation today. We will begin by making a quick note. If you are working on other projects at this time, we suggest that you give full attention to today's presentation because each slide, the information on each slide, is dependent on what is presented in each previous slide. So it's very important to be able to follow each slide through the entire presentation to get the full understanding of what we're trying to present today. So let's proceed with the agenda by going to the first slide of the presentation. Okay, so the main focus of today will be on debugging and problem analysis. We'll start off by giving a few quick tips on how to use Wireshark filter expressions, how to use the packet searching capabilities within Wireshark, as well as some information on how to save capture files once they've been collected. In addition, we'll get into more details about packet correlation with other logs. We'll dive into some problems, common problems that you might see in your WebSphere environments, HTTP server environments, and basically how to find those requests in the packet trace. In addition, we will finish the presentation with an understanding on how to decrypt SSL packets, since encrypted packet traces, you cannot see the data, so it's important to understand how to decrypt those packets so that you can actually see the data being passed between the client and the server. And so we will end the presentation covering that topic. So let's proceed to slide number 3. Okay, what I'd like to do at this time is turn the presentation over to my colleague, Marvin Knight, who will go through a few quick tips with you.
Thanks, Rob. Let's proceed to slide 4, and we'll start with the tips. The first tip we're going to cover is using filter expression. The expression we're going to cover is going to involve looking for a specific status code and then also searching for a specific port at the same time. You start this off by clicking on the expression button on the Wireshark window. Slide 5, please. Once you've done that, this will bring up the filter expression panel, and you would scroll down to the particular area that you want to use the expression on. In this particular case, we're wanting to do an HTTP expression, so we go scroll to that and then expand it. Within that, we're looking for the HTTP response code because we want to look for something like a response code 500. Now, one quick note here. You can see in the yellow it says that it requires to decode as HTTP. That requires that you're using a protocol or a port that's already specified as HTTP protocol, or you would have to select decode as HTTP on the packet itself. So in your Wireshark window, you can right-click on one of the packets that has that particular port and then select decode as HTTP. Later in the presentation, Rob will actually show you doing that. So we've selected the response code filter. And then from there, you would select the double equal sign and then put in the value you want to search for. Slide 6, please. As you can see, it puts up the http.response.code equal 500. Now, one of the little notes here, you don't actually have to go through the dialog to set this expression up. If you know the actual codes to enter, you could manually do this. But we're showing you going through the actual filter expression panels, assuming you wouldn't know ahead of time what the actual expressions are. So if you actually knew http.response.code was what you wanted for a filter, you could have just typed that into the filters area itself. Now we go back into the filter expression in this case because we want to add a second expression. We've scrolled to the TCP area. We expand that, and then we select tcp.port. Once again, select the double equal for equal, and then specify port 80. Slide 7, please. Now, you'll notice initially the screen shows red, indicating you have an error in the way it's coded. And the reason for that is you haven't added in a Boolean expression to AND or IT. So in this case, I just add in space, AND space, and the screen switches to green, indicating it's a valid expression. You click Apply, and then that will actually run the filter against your data. Screen 8. Once that's done, you now have your screen showing with your filter showing your response code 500 with TCP port equal 80. From this point, you then right-click on the packet or one of the packets and do a follow TCP string and then hit enter. Slide 9, please. That will bring up the follow TCP string, and you can now see the packets for the response code 500. This would be the entire string associated with this 500 response code. Slide 10, please. So once we close that screen, you now have all of the packets associated with it where you can research what went on and what may have caused the 500 response code. Slide 11. The next tip, number 2. When you're in your follow TCP stream, you can scroll through all the packets that were associated with that connection. Oftentimes, this is a very large stream. So you may be looking for something specific in this stream. You have the ability to click on the Find button towards the bottom of that panel, and then type in a value to find. In this particular case, I typed in etag colon because there was a specific header I was interested in regarding a plug-in problem we were researching. So you hit your value, hit find, and it will locate that for you. Screen 12, please. The next tip, you may want to find an EBCDIC stream that's actually in the packets themselves. From the Edit toolbar, you would select Find Packet. That would bring up a panel where you can type in the value that you're going to search for. So if you know the specific request that may be of interest, in this case, we were looking for git/IBM/console/login.do. We knew there may have been a problem with this particular GET request. So you can key everything in, select packet bytes, and then hit the find key or the find button. Packet, or slide 13, please. That will then locate that particular the very first of those GET requests. Hopefully you're not dealing with a case where there's hundreds of these GET requests. But if there's more than one, you do have the capability of doing a find next and basically going through the trace looking for specific requests until you find the one you're interested in. This would be most useful if you're dealing with maybe five or six of these type requests where you can easily look through them and find the one you're looking for, or you know a specific time associated with it, and it's easy enough to locate it within a time period. If you were dealing with 200 or 300 GET requests and a very large trace, you might not want to use this technique, but possibly some other filter. Screen 14, please. Next tip. You can, once you've located packets you're interested in or you've run a filter, you may want to save that particular result. You can do a save as and save the packets. Now, there's multiple ways of doing save as. Once you're into the save screen, you can either save what's been captured, what's been displayed, or in this particular case, I'm saving a range. I may have had a very large trace, and I just want to save it in small chunks to look at and make it a lot faster to go through. In this particular case, I'm doing a range of 1 to 500, save it as a file, then do 501 to 1500 and save it again. It's just an easy way to break it up into smaller, manageable areas. Screen 15, please. Now, before we go into that, I'll also mention there's also different ways to break up packet traces. Wireshark provides a command called edit cap. This can be used to do a split of your Wireshark or of your cap file or your trace file. I would suggest you research that on the wireshark.org documentation, but you have the ability to use edit cap minus lowercase c and then specify a size of how many packets you want to capture, and Wireshark will automatically split your large file into smaller pieces. This could be useful if you're dealing with something like a 1 gig IP trace. All right, at this point, I'll turn it over to Rob.
Great. Thank you, Marvin. Let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 16. Okay, so what we're going to talk about now is we're going to talk about packet correlation with other logs. As already mentioned in the previous Westy presentation titled TCP Packet Tracing Part 1, packet tracing can be helpful in debugging many different types of technical problems. For example, if you're having HTTP header problems, large file downloads or post-upload problems, very useful to collect a packet trace for those type of issues, general TCP connect failures, premature connect closures and packet delays, if you're dealing with delays in the network, as well as SSL handshake problems. These are all types of problems that you may encounter in your environments where you would need to collect a packet trace to find out more information. I want to be clear, though, that the purpose of this section will not be about solving any particular problem, but instead the main focus will be to demonstrate how to find the correct request and TCP connection in a packet trace using all of the information available to you. Okay, this is information discovered from other WebSphere-related logs, and we're going to go ahead and look at that here shortly. Okay, but it's very important you want to find the correct request and TCP connection in a packet trace because it's vital to debugging any of the above-mentioned technical problems. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 17. Okay, so one thing to keep in mind, when you're getting ready to analyze a packet trace, okay, you have a problem, and you went ahead and you've collected your packet trace. There is some important information that you need to know ahead of time, okay, to help you in review of these files. Okay, one, the IP addresses. If you know there's a particular client that's having a problem, if you know that IP address, you want to write that down. You definitely want to know the IP addresses of the servers that you're debugging, especially the one where you actually enabled your packet trace on. If there's any middle devices like a firewall, load balancer, some hardware appliance sitting in between your client and your server, and you've enabled the packet trace on the server, for example, you want to make sure that you know the IP address of that middle device. Okay, because a lot of times middle devices can mask the client IP address so that you don't see it in your packet trace on the server side. What you're only seeing is the IP address of the middle device. So it's very important to know what that IP address is, if at all possible. As well as port information. You want to know what listening ports your server is listening on. For example, port 80, port 443. If you have a middle device, such as the load balancer, and that's listening on port 80, you want to make sure that you know clearly, before you start to analyze the packet trace, what ports your devices are listening on. Finally, MAC addresses. Not a requirement, but if you know what the MAC addresses are of the devices that you're tracing, it's good to write those down, because you will see that in a packet trace, and sometimes you'll see that a failed packet is coming from a specific IP, maybe a client IP, but the actual MAC address will show that it's some network device sitting in front, or I should say, in between the client and the server. So if you know that information, it can be helpful when you're debugging. In addition, you want to know some specific information about the systems where you went ahead and collected your packet trace. Okay, for example, you want to know what the time zone is of that machine. Very important, and the reason for that is, for example, if you run a packet trace on a machine, let's say that's in the Central Daylight Time Zone, and you collect the packet trace, you now view that packet trace on your workstation, but you're in the Eastern Time Zone. By default, the packets are going to show up on your machine. They're going to show up in the Eastern Time Zone timestamp, even though the packet trace was collected on a machine running in the Central Daylight Time Zone. And you'll see that later on in the packet trace, but in the analysis that we're getting ready to do. But it's very important to note what the time zone is of the machine that you're collecting the packet trace on. In addition, you want to know the system date and clock time, because if someone reports that the problem happened at a certain time for them, well, if it doesn't correspond to the system clock of the machine you're tracing, it can throw you off when you're trying to analyze the trace. Okay, so you may need to make adjustments in your understanding when you start sorting through the actual trace. In addition, if you know it, you want to know the full URL of the request that failed. For example, if a client reports that they're getting a post failure on a specific URI and you're tracing that in your packet trace, you want to make sure they give you that information so that when you do your searching, you're searching on the right URLs. Okay? And then finally, the date and time of the failure. Obviously, good information to know. Okay? So anyhow, let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 18. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start here with problem number one. Okay, the problem number one that I want to talk about is a performance problem. And we're going to start off by looking at the WebSphere plugin trace. And what we see here is when we're analyzing our WebSphere plugin trace, we'll see that we have a request here for /snoop. We see what the actual host is, www.xyz.com. We see that this is an HTTPS request handled on port 443 of the web server. And we see what the client IP address is in this case, 7.211.65.8. So that's the client IP address that actually initiated this GET request. And we see that it came in on the web server port 443. We know what our host is, www.xyz.com. And we can see that the plugin sent this request to the WebSphere machine, and the WebSphere machine is listening on port 9081. So it's very important information, good information that you can get from your plugin trace. But here you see that we wrote the request, and the plugin immediately went to read the response. You'll notice here that the request was sent at 1547.09, but the actual response did not arrive back at the plugin from WebSphere until 1547.14. So there is a 5-second gap there. So the question you need to ask yourself when you're debugging is, okay, is this a network problem? Is this a problem within WebSphere where WebSphere is just slow to respond? Or possibly is it that the packet arrived quickly on the web server machine, but the plugin is taking a long time to read in the packet? Okay? So what we want to do now is we have the plugin trace. We have a packet trace now. Let's go ahead and find this request in the packet trace. That is the purpose of this section. We want to just be able to tell you how to find the request in the packet trace so that you know you're looking at the right connection. So let's go ahead to slide number 19. Okay, so the very first thing you want to do, since we know that the delay is between the plugin and the WebSphere port 9081, we know that from looking at the plugin trace, the very first thing we want to do is decode port 9081 traffic as HTTP. So what you would do is you would decode as HTTP allows you to see the requests, for example, the GET in the info column. Because before you decode a packet trace, the info column will not show you the actual request. Okay, so you want to be able to see those requests in the info column if at all possible. So what you do is you, step one is you right-click on the packet, you select decode as. Step number two is you select your destination port that you want to decode. In this case, we're decoding traffic to WebSphere port 9081. And then finally, step three is we indicate what we want to decode it as. In this case, we want to decode as HTTP. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 20. Okay, so next, after you've decoded, the very next thing you want to do is you want to click on the protocol column, so that all HTTP decoded packets show at the top of the trace as shown below. Okay? The very next thing you want to do is you want to scroll down until you see the packet that contains the GET request and the timestamp, in this case 154709, because that is the time in the plugin trace that we saw that the plugin actually wrote the request to port 9081. So now that we've seen that this packet here is sent at 154709, we want to take a closer look at that connection, because all we're looking at now is a bunch of packets in this packet trace. We've scrolled down to the packet that contains our GET request, but now we want to isolate that connection and take a closer look at it. So you right-click on it and select Follow TCP Stream. Proceed to slide number 21, please. Okay, so once you right-click and follow TCP stream, the very first thing that's going to come up is the follow TCP stream window. Okay, the stream window appears showing the requests, and it's going to show all the requests handled over this single connection that we're now looking at. Now, if you notice, the very first request matches the request shown in the plugin log. That is very good indication that we are looking at the right request. So if you were to go back and look at your plugin trace again, if you look at all the headers that we saw in that plugin trace and you compare it now to what we're seeing in this trace window, you'll see that they match exactly. The client IP address is listed, the port 443, we see the JSession cookie ID, we see the accept headers, the refer, and the actual request. Okay? So I'm pretty confident when I'm looking at this, because all these headers match exactly what I saw in my plugin trace, I know that I'm looking at the packet that was sent at 154709, so I know that I'm looking at the right request. So at this point, I can go ahead and close the window, okay, by hitting the close button there so that I can take a closer look at this TCP stream connection. So let's proceed to slide number 22. Okay, so now that we've closed the window, we're now looking at just this particular connection. So the very next thing you want to do is you want to make sure that you're looking at the packets in sequential order. Okay, so what you can do is click on the number column to sort the connection by packet number. This will ensure that the packets are listed in sequential order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Okay, so what are the results here? Okay, packet number 4427, okay, shows the GET / SNOOP request. You can see it clearly there, and you'll notice the time. Okay, it's 154709 is when that packet was actually sent from the plugin side, whose IP address is 92.168.55.4. Then we look at packet number 4428. You can see it's an immediate ACK from the WebSphere side. In this case, IP address 3.136.53.13, and you can see that the port is 9081. Okay, and then the very next packet number is 4433. This is the actual 200 HTTP response headers from the WebSphere application server. Okay, you'll notice here that this packet is sent by WebSphere side 5 seconds after the previous ACK, which was at 154714. Okay, so what we're showing here, or what I am able to confirm here, okay, I'm not able to determine root cause. Again, that's not the purpose of this presentation. But what I am able to determine is, one, I confirmed that I found the correct request that I saw in the plugin trace. And now I can see that we wrote the request at 154709, but I didn't actually get the 200 response headers back from WebSphere until 5 seconds later. So I know I can at least eliminate that this is not a web server or plugin issue, that it may be a network problem, or it may be a delay in the WebSphere side. So at that point, I would want to take a further or a closer look at maybe the WebSphere side tracing, maybe get some performance doc from WebSphere during a recreate, or possibly take a TCP packet trace on the other side, on the WebSphere side, to see if I see a delay there as well. So just that would be the next course of action in this case. But as you can see, we clearly are able to identify the connection in this particular packet trace. Okay? All right, so let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 23, please. Okay, so now I'm going to proceed on to a different problem. In this particular case, we're looking at a WebSphere web container trace. Okay, in this case, trace.log. So this trace was collected on the WebSphere side. Okay, this is your regular WebSphere web container trace log. Okay, and we indicate here a failed post due to an invalid content length. So what the WebSphere trace is telling us is some very important pieces of information. We know that this is a post. We know that that the URI for the post is WS samples. We know the host that this request came from. In this case, it's robo.relay.ibm.com. The important piece of information here, or the most important piece, I should say, is the content length. We can see that WebSphere is expecting 487500 bytes of data. Okay, so we know that this is a post request, and we know what WebSphere is expecting. How many bytes of data is WebSphere expecting to receive? But what WebSphere is reporting here is that it did not receive that number of bytes. Okay? Now, the other important piece of information here is at the bottom. It tells us exactly what connection this post was received on. This is the information that we can utilize when we're looking at our packet trace. So here we see that the local IP address of this WebSphere machine is 9.42.135.23, and the port that this request was received on was port 9080. And we see that the remote machine, we know what the remote host name is. We know it's robo.relay.ibm.com. And we know what the IP address of that remote machine is, 9.37.235.185. And we can see what the source port is that that request actually came out on. Okay, or sent out on, I should say. So what we want to do now is we want to take a look at the web server side, okay, to get a better understanding of what's going on. So let's first bring up the packet trace. So let's go to slide number 24. Okay, so this packet trace was collected on the WebSphere box. Makes sense, because that's where WebSphere was reporting that it didn't receive all of the valid content it was looking for. So we gathered some information from that trace. We know what the IP address of the web server box is. We know what the IP address of the WebSphere box is. We know what the source port was of the web server machine that actually made the request. And we know what the listening port of WebSphere was that actually received the request. So we can now take that information and build a filter. And the filter in this case that I built is two IP address filters, okay, using the two IP addresses that we know. And then we also did use the TCP port filters, which indicate the two ports that were used for this connection. So by entering it in this IP trace filter window, if I click on apply, what immediately happens is the TCP window comes up showing me the request that was handled over this connection. So we had a complete packet trace. We put in the filter using the information that we gathered from the WebSphere trace. We now are looking at just that connection in this packet trace. And we can see by looking at the filter window that, in fact, this request is what we saw on the WebSphere side. We can see that the content length header matches. We can see the post request matches, that the host is correct. We can see now what the client IP address is. In this case, we know it's the .185. We can see that this request was received on port 80 of the actual web server, and then we can start to see the data. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 25. Okay, so now that we know that this, we know the WebSphere side indicated did not receive all the data, we know we found this request in the packet trace, and we can clearly see that this was a request that was a plugin request, and now what we want to do is take that information and find that exact request in the WebSphere trace log. Okay, so when we bring up the WebSphere trace log, we can search on that particular request, and here it is listed here. So what we are able to determine now is we're able to determine that the plugin had received this post request from client 9.37.235.1. We didn't know that previously, but we know it now. Okay, so we know where this post came from. It came from an actual client machine, browser in this case, 9.37.235.1. We know that the plugin had received the headers and actually wrote those headers to WebSphere. WebSphere was then waiting for the data, but the plugin reports an error saying that it only read 30220 bytes from the actual client before the actual client connection had either closed or there was a problem on the client side. Okay? So as a result of that, since the plugin had failed to read in that body data from the client side, the plugin then in turn closes the connection back to WebSphere, and WebSphere has thus reports the error as invalid content length. Okay? So again, we started with a WebSphere trace. We found the request. We got some information from the WebSphere trace to help us find that request in the packet trace. And then we're able to see that it was a plugin request. We then go to the plugin trace log, find that request, and sure enough, this shows us, okay, now we understand why WebSphere didn't receive all the content data, because the plugin never received all the content data from the actual client machine, in this case, 9.37.235.1. So the next course of action in this case would be to go to possibly invest the client side. Maybe enable a fiddler trace, maybe enable another packet trace on the client machine. There's a device in front of the web server. Maybe the next step would be to collect the packet trace there. Okay? So now that we've seen this, I'm going to take it a little step further and show you another problem. So we'll proceed to slide number 26. Okay. So here, this is very similar to the problem we just debugged, but this time I'm starting with the actual plugin trace. So here we see in the plugin trace on the web server, again, I had mentioned early on that it's important to get IP address information ahead of time if you can. So in this case, I know the IP address of the web server, 192.168.185.2, and I see here an error in my plugin trace. And it shows that there was a post body read failure from the client side at 0745.31 Central Daylight Time. Okay? Very important to note the time. You'll see that in the next slide. But here you can see that at 0745.31 Central Daylight Time, plugin had detected a read failure from the client. So the plugin was waiting for post body data, and as it was waiting for the data, it detected there was a read failure reading in that data. So what we want to do now is we want to find out, well, what request are we talking about here? The best way to do that is let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 27. Okay? Once you isolated the thread that reported the error, you can scroll up and you'll on that same process ID and thread in the plugin trace, and you'll actually see the request now. So we know that in this particular case that the request that failed was a post for slash snoop, and we can get some other important information that we didn't know beforehand. We know what the host is now. We know it's www.xyz.com. We know what the content length is. We know that it was 50266 bytes of data. We know what the J session ID is that was passed by this client. We know the web server port that received this request. In this case, it's 8080. And we also know the IP address of the actual client that submitted this post. In this particular case, it's 10.12.5.6. So what we want to do now is use the information that we've gathered from this plugin trace and find this request in the actual packet trace. Okay, so let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 28. Okay, so again, we're going to create a filter using the information that we now have available to us. Okay, we know what the client IP address is. In this case, we know it's 10.12.5.6. We know what the web server IP address is, 192.168.185.2, and we know what the port is that IHS was listening on that accepted the request, in this case 8080. Where did I get all this information? I got the information from the plugin trace, and I also did my own research, and I know what my web server IP is. Okay, very important to get that information. So you go ahead and create that filter, and go ahead and click on Apply. Okay, and we'll go ahead and proceed to slide number 29. Okay? Once you do that, once you click on Apply, it's going to go ahead and filter out that connection in your packet trace. So now we're only looking at the connection that corresponds to what we saw in the plugin trace. All right, so now we want to take a closer look. What we can do is we can scroll down to the time that matches the post-read failure seen in the plug and trace, which, as I mentioned, was 7:45:31 Central Daylight Time. Or in this case, the packet time would be 8:45:31 Eastern Daylight Time, because I'm looking at this packet trace on my machine, and I'm in the Eastern time zone. That's why I had mentioned earlier, it's very important to get the time zone information from a machine that the trace was collected on, because it may be different when you're looking at it on your local machine if you're in a different time zone. Okay? So notice here that the reset, okay, notice we see a reset coming from 10.12.5.6. We know from looking at the plug-in trace that that is the actual client IP, and we can see that there's a reset here coming from that client at the time of the failure. Okay? The reset is a forced reset of a connection at the TCP layer. So what does this tell me right off the bat? This tells me that, okay, plug-in got a post request, was starting to read in all those bytes of data that it said it was looking for, and in the middle of reading in that body data, plug-in detected a read failure. I then filtered the packet trace, I found the request, and I look and see that I got a reset from the client side in the middle of sending data. Okay? Now I'm going to go ahead and prove that to you in just a few minutes here. But the reset is very important to understand. A reset is a forced closure of the connection. Okay? It's usually not a clean closure. It's actually a forced closure. So when you see reset, that's usually a good indication that there may be a premature closure taking place here. Okay? So what I want to do now is I want to right-click on that packet because I want to take a closer look at that particular communication. So in this case, I would right-click on it and select Follow TCP Stream. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 30. Okay? Once I filter the stream, we can see the request handled over this connection. As you can see, if you look at all the header information and compare that to your plug-in trace, you can compare the JSession ID you see here and what was in the plug-in trace. You can compare the other headers, and sure enough, you can confirm that you're looking at the actual correct request. In this case, the content length matches 502.666, so we know that that is the number of bytes that the plug-in was expecting. All right, so now that we're confident that we're looking at the right request and connection in the packet trace, let's go ahead and take a closer look. So proceed to slide number 31. Okay, so this is where it gets very interesting. The packet details pane shows the number of data bytes contained in each client packet. So whenever you select a packet coming from the client side, again, the client sending post data, and each one of these packets we see coming from the client side is containing a little piece of that body data. If you click on a packet and then look at the details section of the packet trace, you'll see the actual number of bytes listed. In this case, it shows that this particular packet that I've highlighted contains 1460 bytes of data. Okay, so packet number 49420 contains the post headers for this request. So that's the very first packet that we received that contained the post headers. Okay, all the additional packets after that are the actual body data packets, and each packet contains 1460 bytes of data. Okay, so if you count the number of body data packets from the client, starting with the first packet number, which is 49427, to the last packet number, which is 49511, and you count those total number of packets, each one contains 1460 bytes of data, and you add that up, it equals 49640 bytes of data. Okay? That's the number of bytes that the plugin received before it received that reset packet from the client side, which in this case, the reset happened on packet 49512. Okay? And this matches exactly what we saw in our plugin trace. If you look at the plugin trace, the plugin reported that it only read 4964 bytes of the expected 50266 bytes of data. Okay? So again, this is a great way to then go into your packet trace. You looked at your plugin trace first, you saw the error, you then scrolled up in your plugin trace and you saw what the actual request was, you saw what the content length was, so you knew how many bytes of data the plugin was expecting to receive, but then plugin reported an error, that it didn't receive all the bytes. Instead, it reported that it only received 49640 bytes of data. Then you went into your packet trace using that information. You created the filter. You then found the packet. You right-clicked. You followed TCP stream. And now you followed it from the very first packet. We know that each packet contained 1460 bytes of data. And we then scroll down to the very last packet, added those up, and we can see that, in fact, it matches what we saw in our plug and trace. So, again, this would point to a client-side problem. All we knew initially was that this was a reported to IBM as a plug-in problem. Plug-in reported an error saying that it failed to read in-body data. But sure enough, now that you've collected a packet trace, gone through the analysis, you can clearly see that plug-in is reporting correctly that it only received a certain number of bytes and that there was an actual error on the connection. Packet trace confirms that a reset came from the client side. So the very next thing you would probably want to do is investigate the client side. Maybe enable another packet trace on the client side. If there's any middle devices, again, you may want to enable a packet trace there and then recreate the problem and take a look on that side, again, using all the information available to you. Okay? So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 32. Okay? What I'd like to do now is I'm going to hand over this presentation back to Marvin, who will wrap up our presentation for today, and he'll then hand it over back over to Joseph.
Thanks, Rob. As you can see, the next topic is we're going to show how to decrypt SSL packets. So if we can proceed to slide 33. To decrypt SSL packets, Wireshark needs the RSA key in the PEM format in order to do this. When you're dealing with IHS and the plugin, we have a KDB file, and there's no straightforward way to actually pull off the private RSA key. So what we have to do is use a combination of IKeyMan and OpenSSL to be able to extract that information, and then Wireshark will be able to utilize what we extract with the OpenSSL and then use that RSA key to decrypt the packets. So the next few slides, we're going to show you how to do this. Proceed to slide 34, please. Initially, you're going to need to start off by opening IKeyMan and pulling your personal certificate up. So you invoke IKeyMan, select the KDB that's involved for the particular web server or plugin that we're looking at, and then you select the personal certificate, and you want to export that certificate. So you select the Export Import button and hit Enter. Slide 35, please. This will then pull up a panel where you can select the key file type. You want to select the PKCS12. Provided a name, and then hit Enter, or OK. That also is going to require you to then supply a password, which you will need later. So make sure you write down what that password is that you enter and confirm with. Slide 36, please. Now that we've created that file, we need to use OpenSSL. So you'll need to go to a command prompt and then run the OpenSSL command. And we'll run that against the P12 file that we just extracted or exported in the prior step. The command you see here, fairly long, drawn-out command. I won't read it off to you, but that's the actual command you would want to issue to then go create your PEMX file. Slide 37, please. The next step, you'll need to supply the password that you created in the IKeyMan step. So you type in the password. Then in the next screen, you'll see that it shows you that it verified that, and it'll give you the OK. And now you'll have a PEMX file that's been created. Slide 38, please. The next step is then to create the RSA file. And once again, this is showing you the exact command to do this. And we're using this against my file that we've been using the entire time. So we type in the existing file that was just created. Then you give it the new parameters. And you hit enter. And now you have your RSA file created. Now, the main pieces to pull out of this are the actual commands for OpenSSL that you're seeing in the screenshots. This is actually running against my KDB, and this was a live actual way of doing it. So what you're seeing is the actual command. So that's the important thing to pull out of these screens. Slide 39, please. Now, once we've created that RSA file, we then want to show you, if you don't have that in your Wireshark, when you try to look at an SSL string, you won't see anything. In the data here on this slide, you'll see that we tried to follow the TCP string for an SSL packet, and it just pulls up a blank SSL string. So if nothing's decrypted, you can't see anything. Slide 40, please. Now, to utilize the RSA file that we created, you want to go to the Edit Preferences. So you go to the toolbar, select Edit, and then Preferences. You hit Enter on that. Slide 41, please. This will bring up your Preferences panel. And you want to expand the item that says Protocols. And then that will list all the different protocols available to you. And in this particular case, we're looking for SSL, so we scroll to SSL and then select that. Now, just a brief digression here. In the prior section, Rob was going through and showing you how to decode as HTTP. If you know that you're going to be processing HTTP or SSL requests on non-standard ports, such as we do with the app servers, such as 9080, 9081, 9082, 9083, this would be where you could permanently set those ports so that they're always decoded that way. There's also an HTTP protocol that you could select off of this preferences, and within that, you could specify those ports to always be decoded that as HTTP. Likewise, for SSL, you could specify that certain ports are always decoded as SSL as well. For this, though, we're just going to be specifying the RSA key for SSL, and that's where we're going to supply the RSA file that I created with OpenSSL. Screen 42, please. Now, you can see here under the RSA keys list, I type in a specific value, and I have the little window below the SSL debug. That's an expansion of what was actually in the RSA keys list. That's the format you need to specify. You give it the IP, the port, the HTTP, and then the actual path to the RSA file. You would then hit Apply or OK. Screen 43. Now that we've applied that, once again, we can try and follow a TCP stream on an SSL packet. And this time, you can see that it actually decodes the values. So supplying that RSA key that we created now allows you to successfully see the encrypted data. Slide 44. At this point, we've basically gone through and given you tips on how to do expressions or different filters. We've shown you how to save a TCP packet capture into more manageable files or captured files. We've gone through the debugging process on how to correlate TCP packet traces with different Webster logs, plug-in logs, and then we've shown you how to export a certificate from a key file, create an RSA private key, and then use that to decrypt your packets. Slide 45, please. At this point, Joseph?
Thank you, Robert and Marvin, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for questions.
And we have no questions.
Thank you, Jackie. I see a question here coming from the group chat from Mark, and his question is, can you store multiple private keys in Wireshark?
You're supposed to be able to. The documentation states you can. I haven't actually tried it myself, but you're supposed to be able to. Personally, I just usually select the one I'm dealing with to keep it simple, but I would say go for it.
Thank you, Rob. And at this point in time, we will conclude the presentation.